My name is Maxim, and I'm one of the locals here, right? Normally I would be part of the organizing committee, but this year I was mostly at CERN, and so dumped all the hard stuff on Cliff. Okay, so I'll give you four lectures themed dark sectors, and we'll be discussing dark matter, its connection to Standard Model. So it's mostly theoretical ideas how that came about, but we'll connect to some activities that go on, in particular direct searches of dark matter and so on. So the first lecture is more introductory, and it builds on what you heard from Veronica and from Matthew on Standard Model, on some ideas of beyond Standard Model physics, and let's get to it. Say a few words about the Standard Model. Then we of course heard that it's based on this gauge group, and which describes very well the existing observed forces in the Standard Model. That is strong electromagnetic weak forces. With the discovery of the Higgs boson, we have discovered a new type of force, the Yukawa force, fundamental Yukawa force between the particles, and with that, the Standard Model is complete. It has no free parameters, so our predictions are incredibly successful in the sense that if you ever came across particle data group book, which is that thick in the full unabridged version, that all of that is pretty much described by the Standard Model, based on three gauge groups, three families, and so far one Higgs doublet. However, there is also some evidence for new physics, and in particular, it comes from neutrino physics and cosmology, right? So in neutrino physics, we have masses and oscillations. Sometimes people say that, this is not really Standard Model, beyond Standard Model physics, because this could be included in the Standard Model. True, but if we take a point of view that Standard Model is really what's been written in 67, there was no need for any neutrino masses or fields that will provide the neutrino masses. So it's an extra ingredient. So I would classify it as beyond Standard Model physics. And cosmology, of course, provides us with evidence for dark matter that, why is doing this? Sorry, I'm not too familiar with that medium, but we'll get through that. So cosmology provides us with some evidence of dark matter, firm evidence, I should say, and coming from various different scales. And so far, we can see that probably this is these are particles. These are objects outside of the Standard Model. At least these are not ordinary atoms that we know as part of the Standard Model. So most likely, this is also an indication on existence of new physics. So each decade in physics can be thought of some iconic pictures will stay with us forever. So one of the most iconic pictures is this, right? Plot for the discovery of the one of the plots for the evidence for the Higgs boson, right? So do you know what's pictured here?
One on the right, Tom talked about it, so.
All right, so very well. So this is the four lepton channel, which means that two mu's, two e's, or four mu's, etc. Spectra measured at colliders, and you see the beautiful peak on the left coming from four muons. This is the rate that was not previously measured. It's basically a Z boson splitting to a pair of muons, emitting a photon and giving another pair of muons. So if you add the invariant masses, it reconstructs the mass of the Z boson at 91 GeV, right? To the right, you see the at a higher energy, you see the peak associated with production of two on-shell Z bosons that would, two quarks collide, create two pairs of Z particles. Very, very, very small rate. Nobody was before LHC was observing that many pairs of Z bosons. So this is single Z. This is the 2z, each of which decay to mu plus, mu minus, or e plus, e minus, and in the middle, this is the reason why physicists are so excited, right? This is the new particle. Let's call it H125, or the Higgs boson with a mass of 125 GeV when basically a Higgs particle splits into an on-shell Z boson, an off-shell Z boson that gives a pair of leptons, and this thing also gives a pair of leptons. So this is a great discovery, and as I said, it's also points to after that, the standard model is really complete. We know experimentally that this particle is well consistent with properties of zero plus resonance scalar with positive parity, and it's remarkable that it was discovered based on, it was predicted based on theoretical consistency and discovered 50 years ago after the 50 years after the prediction with exactly the properties that people thought it would in the 60s and 70s. So very well, one thing that you should think of is that this prediction is also important. That important ingredient in this prediction was the minimality. That is, if we would have 10 Higgs bosons, right, or 10 sectors that break electroweak symmetry, there would be no one-to-one prediction for example, the mass is a free parameter, right? But once you see the peak, you should, in the minimal model, you should be able to tell what the height of the peak is, and that's all calculated, and it's all very much consistent with what observed, right? But if you have 10 or so Higgs bosons, right, the signal would undoubtedly change, right? And that the fact that nature chose a very minimal path is quite remarkable, right? Very well. The minimality doesn't stop there. The LHC has a huge program at looking at sort of new physics at high energy, right? What is it all about? Well, you heard about the ideas of new physics, but let's take an example of maybe the gauge group of the standard model the fundamental theory is described not just the product of these gauge groups, but maybe by some another gauge group that that manifests itself at high energy, and it somehow couples to Stern model fermions. Then on top of the here you're looking at say a two lepton picture of particles. Again, the two lepton spectra taking at the Higgs, at LHC, and you see a huge peak associated with the Z production observed with many, let's say, now probably with billions of lepton pairs, and you would look for an evidence for an additional peak at higher energy if this there is a new mediator force Z prime that is part of this construction, and you don't see any, and you constrain. These are all the data from the first run, and you constrain the mass of this new particle to be larger than here 2 TeV, but in basically latest run of the LHC, you can set rough constraints at 4 TeV level, and that is assuming that this particle couples the same as the electroweak gauge group. Okay, so that's very, very strong constraints. And so you can ask the question, where is the new physics? I mean, there were lots of hopes about, SUSY, supersymmetry, extra dimensions. New gauge groups. Etc. None of that is seen. So this kind of also calls first of all we've seen only the first decade of the LHC operation, and it has another 15 to 20 years of running, so there's a lot of things may be still coming hidden in the data. So currently, however, the energy that the machine has reached is only 1 TeV off from the design luminosity from the design energy of 14 TeV, right? So the possibility of producing particles at high energy now lies in increased luminosity, right? And we'll see that maybe some of these ideas pan out. But in any event, it's important to think of what to do next. Maybe recalibrate or rethink our approach in physics. So our approach in physics, in high energy physics, was often based on raise the energy, find a new particle. That was the case with W's and Z's, which we knew would be there based on the evidence of weak decays and parity violation that was seen in previous decades and was discovered in the 80s. It was the same way the top quark was found in the 90s by raising energy. We knew that it's got to be there based on the consistency of electroweak theory and observations at LEP. Higgs was found by not just raising the energy, but also by providing lots and lots of quark-quark collisions, or gluon-gluon collisions at LHC. But it may very well be that future discoveries would be based not necessarily on raising energy, but going deep, getting more and more data out of the LHC, and also out of the experiments at lower energy. And also, we should kind of maybe recalibrate what we think about new physics, that it's not necessarily has to be a new particle, let's say 10 TeV mass, but it could be very well a set of other particles at not necessarily at the very high mass, but maybe much more weaker coupled, and that's the reason why we don't see them. Okay, so this is very generic sort of considerations. Now, of course, we are, like I said, we have clues for new physics, and I listed some. So from Raphael's and Kendrick's talks, you of course heard about precision cosmology and evidence for new physics there. So the chiefly among them is the evidence for dark matter. Then neutrinos have masses and mixing, as I said, use the iconic plot from Snow experiment showing the resolution to the solar neutrino puzzle, which comes from the oscillations, and then there are also theoretical puzzles that, of course, Matthew has talked about, and in particular, strong CP problem, which is the problem of why theta parameter of the QCD is observationally consistent with zero at high accuracy, while it could be order one in the generic theory, right? So theta being close to zero is not contradictory to anything, right? But it's not your general expectation, right? So if you think of the family of theories with the flat priors where theta can go from zero to 2 pi, why is that? And there is a super selection. Once you are at a given theta, you don't relax to zero very easily, right? So the not very easily, not at all, right? So it's going to be there. And there is a question why it's zero, and you heard the solutions to that through the action mechanism. There are issues with vacuum stability of the standard model, Higgs boson vacuum. If you just take and extrapolate if you take standard model, don't add anything else, and extrapolate it to extremely high energies, you will discover that due to the quantum evolution, the Higgs potential the simplest sort of Mexican hat form that we write down is not the end of the story. That there are corrections to it, and with the current values of particle masses, in particular the top mass, if we extrapolate it beyond 10 to the 14 GeV, you will find out that there is another minimum, which is much deeper than the standard model minimum, right? And you can ask the question, how come that we somehow ended up in the correct minimum? This extrapolation obviously assumes that there is no new physics between, say, electroweak scale and the high energy scale, and which is a very strong assumption. So it is most likely that this assumption is way too strong, and there is a new physics that intervenes at intermediate energies and corrects for the shape of the Higgs potential. And of course, one of the things that Matthew I've discussed with you a lot is the problem of smallness of Higgs mass or the Higgs wave scale relative to the highest energy scales that we can think of in nature, and that in particular, for example, God scale, or the God stands for grand unified theories, or Planck scale, right? And that is being a driver for many theories beyond Stern model, okay? And that is what's usually referred to as the gauge hierarchy problem. And so this, it's still there. So there is also, of course, when we think about new physics, a lot of models are motivated by current anomalies in experiments, right? So that there is I'm not going to be very inclusive here. I mentioned some, but the anomalous results is when you get the result in your experiment that is different from what you have thought. Based on your calculations or simulations, and in most of the cases, it turns out to be various mundane explanations, such as errors in calculations, errors in experiment, statistical fluctuations, and so on. There are, however, examples from the past, such as the solar neutrino problem that thought to be, for many years existed as an anomaly, that people could not reconcile the fluxes of the solar neutrinos with the model of the nuclear burning inside the sun, right, and with the temperature profiles and so on, right. So my point is that one should pay attention to anomalous results and possibly investigate what kind of simple Stern model extensions, or not maybe not simple, but what kind of theory space can accommodate the anomalies, right? This is also an important exercise, like a case of the solar neutrinos, thinking of neutrino oscillations between between different flavors led to the snow experiment in Sudbury that allowed to confirm that the flux of neutrinos in all flavors agrees with the predictions of the solar model. So we have to be skeptical about various anomalies that people put forward as an evidence for the Stern model, but for the physics beyond Stern model. But we should be also kind of open to the idea that some of them might be true and have our theoretical options already kind of investigated ahead of time. All right, so speaking about cosmology, one thing that you probably heard from Kendrick, and you'll hear more from Raphael Nodels, that the earlier you go in the cosmological time, that is higher in the redshift, the simpler the universe look like, right? So if you go to the redshifts of on the order of if you go to the redshifts on the order of 800 to the time of the decoupling of the cosmic microwave background from the free streaming of photons, you will discover that the universe is well described by a six parameter model. Okay. And what you see here representative pictures of this six-parameter model fitting very well the statistics of temperature fluctuations as a function of angle, or the same as Fourier transform of the angle, L number. And you see that the model, the baseline lambda CDM, lambda cold dark matter model fits the data very well with, say, the for example, fraction of the with the ratio, for example, of baryons to photons being measured to a percent value. So this we're entering the stage of the precision cosmology where I should say a very simple model at high redshifts pops out, and you can ask the question how to accommodate a simple model with the picture of encapsulated in PDG. How to match that picture with the early universe cosmology that transpires to be very simple with particle physics as we know it. So there is no universal answer to this. Okay. But there are lots of attempts and ideas how to patch these things together. So for me, one of the main motivation to look for a particle dark matter and think of particle dark matter as elementary particle comes from the simplicity of this model, right? So the dark matter was in place the early universe, even before the decoupling of the photons from primordial gas, because we see the effects of wells of dark matter start being developing earlier than the decoupling, and the gas falls into these potential wells. Now. The simplicity of this picture also motivates the to think about possible simple solutions to the dark matter problem, right? So rather than thinking about some very very exotic objects, it is very suggestive that that beyond Stern model there is maybe one or a few of stable particles that somehow provide the missing mass of the universe. Okay, and of course, this is the pie chart that of course you've seen before, with roughly a quarter of dark matter constituting the main fraction of that is allowed to cluster and form galaxies where the baryons fall in. There is a 5% from the normal atoms, which is almost predominantly hydrogen and helium, with a small addition of other elements, either remnants of the Big Bang or the results of the subsequent stellar activity in the universe. And there is 70% of the dark energy that is so far very consistent with a cosmological constant, right? So this is that's the result we have in terms of the energy budget. And we cannot translate that result, for example, very easily into who is the most numerous particle in the universe, right? So this is the pie chart. If you'd like to say, to draw the very same picture for the number of particles, we'd be totally in the dark, because we know how many photons are there relative to baryons a lot more, like 10 to the 10 times more. But then how many dark matter particles or what they are, we have no idea, right? So if these are axions, if I draw the pie chart for the number densities of axions, this would be the universe just consists of axionic particles. All the rest is a small addition. If the dark matter is in forms of primordial black holes, then there are very, very few of them, right? This is a flip side of the statement. We don't know what the mass of dark matter is. Very well. Anyways, this activity is also a kind of let's think for a moment why it's not that easy to connect that picture with particle physics as we know it, right? So the cosmology gives us an overall fraction of dark matter that there is there in the universe, sort of. Looking at the galactic dynamics or the motion of the gas and stars inside galaxies makes us to conclude that there is an average energy density of dark matter around us at 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter, which is, of course, a very sort of particle physics biased units, right? So if you take an astronomer, he will quote you the very same numbers in terms of solar masses per parsec cube, right? But and
that's per cubic centimeter.
Well, anyways, but you can see that the main difficulty, right? The last scales, where you can observe reliably dark matter, come at the distances of 10 to the 21 centimeter, right? Below that, you have no direct evidence that there is dark matter. So it's because it's all observed through its gravitational pulls on stars, and you need quite a big distance to produce that pool, right? And then. Very well, but yet we have a very elaborate program of trying to detect the dark matter particles, right? In various laboratories around the world, in Gran Sasso in Italy, here in Snow Lab, and in the U.S. and so on. And these experiments are organized at maybe 3-4 meter scale. That would be the largest dark matter searching experiments. And obviously, you need to extrapolate by 19 orders of magnitude to actually make any inferences, right? To connect that picture with that picture with that picture, right? So there is a lot of extrapolation, and theory is necessarily your first step, because when people work very hard, and they do work very hard on that. Well, you don't even know, right? When we say, well, the dark matter is all around us, maybe right, maybe not, right? If we're in axions, we're swimming through the sea of axions, which is a dominant component. The Broglie wavelengths overlap. They form a non-interacting fluid around us, if you like, right? If these are the weakly interacting massive particles, they contain one per this coffee cup that you have on the table, right? That's you can say around us, right? But if it's I don't know, the primordial black holes, for by any chance of say a few to maybe 10 solar masses. Then of course they're very sparse, and even more sparse than the stars in the galaxy, and that's of course requires a completely different approach to the search of dark matter. So people who are pictured here made their bet, and the bet is that the dark matter particles are probably some sort of particles that would come in and scatter off the atoms inside their apparatus, and that's how they're going to see. Okay? They're of course scientists, so they will take any data, whatever comes, right? It's the negative data is also a result, right? But that's a different story. So we'll discuss that. So that's the statement that I'd like to make, right? That dark matter can be an elementary. It can be an elementary BSM particle. I don't know why it's doing this. Very well. Let's think about this for a second. And the subsequent goal would be to review the ideas behind. I don't know why it's doing this. I feel that I'm pressing some wrong spot. Review the ideas behind simplest models of dark matter. So let's think about it from the point of view of the thermal history of stair model particles, as we know it. Okay, we are now at the temperature of CMB of 2.7 kelvins. If we translate that to say electron volts, how much is that? Not exactly, but approximately, right? We know that the hydrogen ionizes at 13.6, right? I mean, if we'd be swimming in the radiation that is ionizing, right, and that numerous as the CMB, it would be not good, okay? So... What's that? Much less, yes, much less. Times and times, very good, very good. So one electron volt is something like 11.60 kelvins, right? Did I get it right?
We have a winner.
Yeah. Very well. So right now we are at a fraction of say 3 × 10⁻⁴ electron volt temperature overall in the universe. And a slight digression, and it's not referring to CMB as the temperature is a little bit of a stretch, right? Because it's the purist theorist would say, well, the temperature applies to things at thermal equilibrium, and the CMB is already decoupled. So it's a parameter that looks like a temperature. If some magician would scramble your CMB, right? It will not rethermalize back to the Planckian distribution, right? Just remember. But anyways, if we go back to a very, very early universe, right? That is, let's shrink the universe by, I don't know, a million times. No, that would not be enough. Let's say 10 billion times, right? So the temperature will be in excess of 1 mega electron volts, right? These photons will, if you make it to them, right, that would obviously pair produce E plus E minus, and this thing will thermalize immediately, right? So it's, of course, much more productive to think not reverse in time, but forward in time. So we have a very hot universe with, let's say, 1 MeV temperature and higher, where E plus E minus pairs are as abundant in roughly as normal photons, right? So what happens then when the the universe continues expanding and the temperature drops? Well, the particles like to maintain themselves in the thermal equilibrium, and they find each other here and annihilate, right? And in the at temperatures much larger than the mass of the electron, they as I said, they were completely populated, and then when the temperature drops below the masses of electrons and positrons, their number starts going down according to Boltzmann law, and that is very quickly indeed as the temperature drops. So in the early universe, this process basically eliminates electrons and positrons very quickly, and this process is stopped for electrons and positrons for what reason? We have electrons, right, around. So if I would extrapolate temperature to zero, the exponent of minus, I would have an astronomically small number densities of electrons and positrons. Now this process stops, right, in the early universe. For what reason?
Expansion.
There is an expansion, and the expansion alone is enough to stop the process of E plus E minus annihilation. But that's not the reason. Okay. What happens in the actual universe? Yes, sir, of course. Yes, correct. So there is an intrinsically larger number of electrons relative to positrons. If we go to very early universe, for every 10 billion positrons, there is a 10 billion and one electron, right? So that doesn't sound much more, right? But when this is punished by the number densities by this large factor, this asymmetry comes in, and that's what stabilizes the number densities at subsequent points. Right, so they, in other words, the positrons annihilate completely, and the small leftover left. Right, well, let's consider a hypothetical situation when the asymmetry is zero. Okay, that does not refer to our universe, but to a hypothetical situation when the asymmetry is zero. Then what happens? Then, as some of you said, the expansion will preserve a certain number I was talking too much. The expansion will preserve a certain number of electrons and positrons, right? If by any chance the number, and that's a hypothetical situation, is exactly equal to the number of positrons. That's identity. the of positrons and electrons is exactly the same. Then you will see that the rate for their annihilation. To photons will be proportional to the annihilation cross section times the relative velocity averaged over thermal bath times their number density, which I have already said sort of goes down exponentially, right? So at some point, this annihilation rate will become smaller than the Hubble expansion rate, which in the very early universe is proportional to, you will know from your cosmology course that it's 1/2 of 8 pi over 3 g Newton total rho of the universe. And if you digest it to the radiation domination era, it becomes 1.66 times the square root of the number of degrees of freedom in the early universe, which is very similar to, say, a factor of 5, and then temperature squared over a Planck mass, right? And because the Newton constant is 1 over mass Planck squared, and the Planck mass, if we put it to numbers, is what?
Say it again?
That's the 18 GeV. Right. Where people... there is a divide, right? Some people call there is a Planck mass and reduced Planck mass, right? So the pure theorists use reduced Planck mass, but we're going to just use the Planck mass as the inverse square root of G Newton, in which case it's 1.2 times 10 to the 19 G.
Okay. Very good. So M Planck is 1.2 times 10 to the 19 G. Very well, the important point here that this thing drops as t squared in the early universe, while that factor drops very, very quickly, right? So when the that condition occurs, then we can say that annihilation stops. And then if you go through the math, in this hypothetical universe, the number densities of electrons that we would call freeze out number densities will be at the level of 10 to the minus, 17 relative to the the number of photons. Okay, that is not enough to be consistent with observations. Well, we have also plenty of evidence that the universe is completely asymmetric in terms of electrons and positrons and so on. But that's where the annihilation would roughly stop. And can we use that idea to think about the simplest possibilities for dark matter? Okay? Remember, we need to provide a new species in the universe that should make up for the 25% of the energy, right? So why this number comes out to be so small? That relates to the the value of annihilation cross section here, right? And annihilation cross section is for electrons and positrons is what? Can you give me an order of magnitude estimate for E plus E minus annihilating to two photons?
Well, we can use FineCalc and calculate the diagram, right? The bravest of us, Cliff, can calculate it by hand. But if we think about the couplings and mass scales involved, and also, we're looking at the non-relativistic particles merging together, right? So the mass of the electron is really the only sort of decent energy scale we have here, right? And one thing you should know, the E plus E minus annihilation occurs at the threshold unimpeded, right? Because the particles are attracted to each other by the Coulomb force and then they annihilate. So
Anyone? And this is electromagnetic process, right? So this E plus, E minus coming in. There are two photons. And there is a cross diagram, okay? Then I can calculate that too, right? I should disclose, right? But let's estimate. What is it? In terms of coupling constants, we can calculate the cross section, right? The cross section has to have a dimension, right? So it's a distance squared, right? Or in h bar equals c units is the inverse energy squared, right? The mass of the electron is the only scale, right? So it has to be 1/me², right? But then there are coupling constants as well, right? So there is 1/me², okay? And then alpha squared, right? Because this the diagram itself is proportional to the charge squared, and then it enters, right? So this is very, very, like, you know, very crude estimates, and we can be much more careful with providing pies and everything, and in particular there will be 1/velocity factor for the incoming positrons and electrons. Okay, so but that's the estimate, and if you look at this numerically, I would write it as 1/velocity factor, and then alpha squared. I don't know why it's doing this. Alpha squared over me squared. Can we estimate numerically what it is? Well, let's say alpha is 1/100, right? So this otherwise is very difficult, right? Yes, okay, yeah, I know. So with our precision, I'd say it's 10^-4, right? Divided, let's say, by an MeV, right? It's half an MeV, but okay, that, right? So what do we end up with? Do you guys know how to convert MeVs to distance? Anyone? All right. We'll take that, put here. In h bar equals c equals 1 units, one is equal to 197.3, which is 200 MeV. Times 10^-13 centimeters. Okay, these are conversion units. So you can go with that, and 1 equal to h bar c equal to that, right? So this is going from one unit to another using this is very convenient, right? So I can plug it in back here. So what do? I multiply by the square of that factor, okay? And what do I get? 1/V times 10^-4 times, let's say, 200, right? So this is going to be 4 times 4 times 10^-26 centimeters squared, right? Correct? So I get to the cross sections that are 1/V times 4 times 10^-26 centimeters squared, which is particle physics language would be what? The number I got is 40 millibars.
you know the origin of this, no? The why cross sections is measured in barns, which is
just, broad side of the barn.
What's that?
Hit the broad side of a barn.
Yeah. Well, so one barn is 10 minus 24 centimeters squared, right? So this one of the, it comes historically from studying neutron scattering on nuclei, right? You figure out why people wanted to do that, and in Los Alamos in the early 40s, right? So when people saw that the cross section was much larger than what they thought it should be, right? That's where they decided that it's size of a barn. Anyways, that's a little digression. So we get to that number. And this number gives us that value of roughly the leftover of dark matter particles. So can we sort of generalize that and provide an idea how to get, let's say, decent amount of dark matter, right? Let's say we go from the electron to a picture of chi, okay, of some new particle. We have to add to the same model anyways, I'm arguing. And then what should we do so that we have, let's explore two possibilities, right? I mean, this, the fact is we had so few electrons, and they're not going to be enough in energy density to form the dark matter, is coming from the fact that this cross section that we estimated with you is too large, okay? That they annihilate very efficiently. If we impede the annihilation, okay, we will get in that picture enough particles to saturate the dark matter density, right? And how can we make the annihilation cross section smaller? Okay. Well, we have two options, right? We can make the coupling constant smaller because, well, it's dark matter. We don't know anything about it, right? So we may as well make the coupling constant smaller. Or we can make the mass of this dark matter larger, right? So there is two different sort of options that we can think of, right? So there is we can make smaller couplings, or larger mass. Okay. All right. Well, it turns out, as stepping ahead, it turns out that if we have a new particle, no matter what the mass is, but if it turns out that it's almost valid for any mass, but if we have this particle annihilating into members of the Stern model gauge group with the rate that is roughly one picoborn times C, but okay, C is 1 for me. So this, which is 10 minus 36 centimeters squared, then omega of this chi would be, which is the fractional energy density today, okay, would be similar to omega dark matter observed. Okay, that's the this would be called the weakly interacting massive particle idea, and WIMP stems from the fact that this is a Pico burn. This is a typical size of cross sections. You smack the two protons, and the Z bosons come out. That's the cross sections or a pairs of Z bosons. That's roughly the weak scale of cross sections that you're looking at. Okay? So this simple exercise of thinking about the plus and minus leads us to the one idea how the dark matter may have come around. And the idea is that it was in the thermal equilibrium. It sort of self-annihilated to a point where the annihilation stops by the rarity of these particles. And the freeze-out abundance, freeze-out is a language used in this process, is what created the dark matter that we see today. Okay? Right, I somehow deviated here. Okay. All right. One thing that I want to say is maybe we should not be also very super, super restrictive as to, okay, we would like to have one dark matter particle and nothing else, right? Why am I saying that? Well, think about the 5%, oops. I don't know, this maybe it's I feel that I'm catching something. And, all right, think about uh, 5% of regular matter. Right, that we have in the universe. Okay. This 5% of the regular matter is, as I argued, is hydrogen, helium, plus small other atoms. But we also know, right, that the hydrogen and helium have all these sorts of interactions. We know that ... include three generations of matter fields, right? There are photons that mediate interactions. There are various other matter fields, neutrinos, etc., right? All interactions, right? Now, you can ask the question, okay, I mean, do we have 25% of dark matter? Then we'd say, oh no, it's one particle, right? So that is somewhat of a logical inconsistency, maybe, right? So we may as well think of dark matter coming together with maybe dark forces and dark particles that are not seen so far, that would be, called dark radiation. Some analogs of photons that may exist in the early universe that we haven't discovered yet, but we have tools of looking for that, right? So the idea of dark sectors is that to look at possible candidates for dark matter together with interactions possible candidates for dark matter together with possible let's just say dark forces and dark radiation, okay? Here we would be one thing that I can say, we can be open about the energy scales at which the dark matter may come from. You saw from that example, right, that if I could make it very weakly interacting, right, I could very well end up with the dark matter with mass not so far from the electron mass, right? If the coupling to normal standard model particles is very small, right? So be open about mass scales where dark sectors may exist. Okay. So, introduce another piece of jargon that physicists use: energy and intensity frontiers. That's sound like a DOE person. So, if you think about the sort of a generic force mediated by a massive boson, right? We all know from our maybe undergrad or early courses that corresponds to Yukawa interaction, right? Somehow, right? So if I have a sort of mass, so coupling and the mass of a new particle, then the potential that it introduces is alpha x over r exponent of minus mxr, right? Or if you Fourier transform it, that would be an amplitude for scattering due to that force, and the Fourier transform would correspond to alpha x over p squared plus if this is a space like p squared plus mx squared. Okay, now let's. Let's think let's do a very cartoonish kind of plot. This is the logarithm of alpha x, and it runs negative, and this is a logarithm of mx, and it runs positive, right? So the idea of the basically the energy frontier direction is that you explore particles that are sort of with the mass with the coupling constants of something like from 0 to minus 2, and you push in that direction, and that's the energy frontier direction. And to go in that direction, you need a very very big colliders such as LHC. If on the other hand the coupling constants are very tiny, right? Let's say minus 6 or smaller, which would be extremely tiny particles, but the masses of these particles are around a GeV, then the LHC would not be an ideal machine for looking for such new forces. In which case, you would prefer to have a medium energy but very high intensity experiments, such as the neutrino beam experiments or high intensity plus and minus collisions. The highest intensity E plus and minus machine is. Has just begun operation, tentative operation at Keck Lab in Japan, and it's called the experiment is called Bell 2, and that's going to be an unprecedented number of E plus E minus collisions, so the highest intensity. So this is the intensity frontier direction, right? Frontier direction. And in our quest of finding out where the dark matter may fit inside the Stern model picture, we must explore both in the high energy ends, and that includes very heavy particles, trying to produce and seeing them as a missing energy in colliders, or also be open about the possibility that these are light particles with very small couplings and that they could be seen in the intensity frontier experiments. Now I'd like to basically draw on the things that you've been talking about with Veronica and Matthew, and introduce a possible couplings, right? How can we discuss or discover the dark matter particles in the lab? Only if they have an additional beyond gravitational interactions with our matter, right? So we'll start, and the example of weakly interacting massive particles, you've seen that we needed the interaction between the Stern model and these new particles, right? Because that what depletes them, right? If I make the interaction cross section even smaller than a picobaryon, that would not be a good model because these particles would be annihilating even less, and they would clog the universe, right? So they would contribute much more dark matter than is observed. So it's therefore it's important to actually think about the possible ways the Stern model can interact with the dark matter and or with dark sectors. And let me start with maybe not so heavy dark matter particles. If dark matter particles is at the TeV or heavier, then there are various different higher dimensional operators that, from the point of view of the Stern model, that you can write down, and they would be okay. But let's think about the particles that sit at around, say, a GeV, and that are neutral under the Stern model, and then we can in a broad sense, actually enumerate all the possibilities that that such particles, how they can interact with the Stern model. So, and the key thing here is, of course, the effective field theory logic, and we will look at the lowest lowest dimension interactions, okay? So let's say we try to build a Lagrangian Stern model interacting with the dark sector, right? So very, very generically, I can write it as an operator composed of the Stern model fields and the operator composed of the dark sector. And let's call M and N, or let's say K and N, are the canonical dimensions of these operators. I'm sure that Veronica have gone over the definition of canonical dimension with you.
Right.
Not explicitly, but... All right, okay. So, so let me just say that. So in quantum field theory, we can assign a canonical dimension to all fields. So scalar and vector will have a dimension one. And that comes from the fact that if you write a kinetic term for, say, a scalar field, and you put it in side and action, that has to be dimensionless, okay? Because that goes inside the exponent in the path integral, right? So it has to be dimensionless. And I repeat that I use h bar equals to c units so that our lives are much easier with that, right? Well, so you can see that this is dimension one because this has also dimension one. So squared gives you 4 times d4x is dimension zero, as it should be. The fermion will have in, and we're talking about 4 dimensions, okay? And fermion would be have a dimension of?
3/2.
3/2, very good. So this is a dimension of 3/2. And that's all what I need so far, right? I mean, that's very well. So if, using that fact, I can immediately say that this, if the dimensions of these operators, meaning that I count all the add all the dimensions that exist there, and then there would be a mass scale that entering here in the power of. Now you should tell me what I should be adding. What's that? K plus n, well, that's not all.
Minus 4.
Very good. K plus n, minus 4. lovely. Using this, we will now build the simplest extensions of the standard model that may contain the dark matter sector particles. Okay, so. Let's think first about this sector, okay? That this is the Stern model operator. And so far, notice that I haven't said anything about its properties. Let's start with that I want it to be, say, gauge invariant under the Stern model, but not necessarily scalar or not specifying the Lorentz group representation. It's only this whole thing that will have to be a Lorentz scalar. Then this Stern model operators, the lowest dimension operator that I can write down, that is going to be a gauge invariant operator is what? I cannot write just a mu of the Stern model. it's not gauge invariant, okay? So. What are the 2 lowest dimension operators that you can think of in the Stern model that would be gauge invariant under the Stern model gauge group? There are 2 such operators. Well, as we said, the gauge field is not gauge invariant, right? But the gauge field strength.
That's me and you.
Yeah, the gauge will feel strength will be, right? So therefore we can write down something like F menu of, and there are 3 of them, right? Three of them corresponding to 3 gauge groups. But guess what? The SU2 and SU3 guys would have also an adjoint index on them because they transform, and that makes them not gauge invariant. So this only F menu of the U1 hypercharge factor of the standard model gauge group. Sometimes, for unknown to me reasons, it's
called sub B. I don't know, but that's a high precise gauge group, this is a gauge invariant operator. Okay. Now, right, and I think I missed the one step when we were enumerating. I will strive to make this as small a dimension as possible, because in effective field theory, we always have to start with the lowest dimension operators, right? Okay, this is just a general rule. Now, this is one operator, and where there is another one that is a full gauge invariant combination. If I take any fermion, right, it's not gauge invariant. If I write two fermions together, it could be very well gauge invariant, but it comes with dimension 3. This is, by the way, has a dimension 2, right? So there is yet another operator inside the standard model that has dimension 2.
The Higgs squared?
Yes, correct, yes. H dagger H, that's also same thing, dimension 2.
Excuse me,
sorry. Yes?
Other engaged groups like SU2 and SU3, why don't we take the trace and then make it gauge invariant?
Yes, we can absolutely. We can have a trace of, I don't know, G mu A times G mu A, for example, for SU3 and SU2, and that would have to be a dimension of what?
Four.
Correct. Because it enters directly for example, in the Lagrangian, right? So this is somewhat in my logic higher dimension, because when we add this dark sector operator, it would have to be suppressed by some energy scale. Okay, so that's fine. So this, we already have candidates here of dimension 2. And then there is the next dimension that you can have is dimension 5.5. That's a weird number, I know. But so you have a dimension 5.5 that can be built out of the left-handed doublet of the under SU2 of the leptons times the Higgs field, right? So the left-handed doublet times the Higgs field can make a composite operator that would be a fermionic operator and it would have dimension 5. Okay? Very good. So we can use that, and we can sort of now let our imagination run wild as to what can enter into the dark sector story, right? So there can be various members of the dark sector particles that together with this candidate operators make up interactions inside this. The effective Lagrangian, and we can have say singlet scalars. We can have A mu primes, some new gauge group particles, or we can have new fermions N. And since I ran out of time, I was just going to list this in this slide. Okay. So. You can take, so here in the blue are the standard model operators. In the red, In the red, there are standard model operators. In the blue, there are members of, say, dark sector, right? And these are the lowest dimension operators that you can add to the standard model as possible interactions here. Okay? Now, if you have H dagger H, you can add a scalar squared times the lambda term. Lambda would have no dimension, okay? Because this is overall dimension is 4. This is, or you can take this, if this is
scalar not charged under any dark group. You can add it directly like that, multiplied by the energy scale in the numerator. Such operator, H dagger H times the scalar, is dimension 3 operator. It's the only operator dimension 3 that you can add to the standard model. It sometimes is called super renormalizable portholes, because this thing is stable under the renormalization group evolution and doesn't cause also any problems with the masses of this scalar or the Higgs. Now, the gauge factor, the field strength of the standard model, the U1 factor, right? Well, you can contract it with the U1 factor of the new dark sector vector, for example, and that's sometimes it's called kinetic mixing operator, right? Because it looks like the standard electromagnetic afternoon squared, but it's it involves the dark sector times the standard model thing, and you can see that overall this is a Lorentz singlet, and it's separately gauge invariant under the U1 X gauge group and under the standard model gauge group. Right? So these are all dimension 4 operators. Perhaps the most important term that you can add to the standard model using the dark sector particles is this one. So here the Lorentz indices are suppressed, but L stands for the left-handed lepton. That involves a neutrino and electron. H stands for the standard model head. This is this composite dimension 5 half operator that I was talking about. You multiply it by the dark fermion operator field N. So together, that also comes to the dimension 4 operator, right? So dimension 4 operator, therefore, it will enter in your effective Lagrangian with dimension less coefficient, right? So that is the famous, if you now put Higgs to its vacuum expectation value, that will create the mixing between the N field and the neutrino field, okay? And if the neutrino has the Majorana mass, this N neutrino has the Majorana mass, that will also generate the Majorana mass for the observed neutrino, and that's what I expect Kai will somehow touch on or cover in his lecture. But this is this famous way of generating the masses. It's very similar to the way how the standard model masses are generated This is very similar to the Dirac mass for any other particles that are generated inside the standard model. But here there is a new full singlet under the standard model gauge group N that I have added. Now we can discuss also other modifications of when you basically where you can object here. Saying that I have used the gauge non-invariant operator I mu and I coupled it to the some sort of standard model currents. There is a number of specific quantum numbers of the gauge of the standard model particles that can be gauged. Okay, so without any problems. So, for example, you can gauge an accidental symmetry of the standard model B minus L. It's probably should be the end of the lecture. Sorry, I just take 1 second. What happened? Okay. Very well. So there are a number of possibilities here. And finally, you have discussed with Matthew a possibility that there is a very light, nearly massless particle that comes from the high sector up, called axion, that is whose derivatives can couple to the gauge currents of the standard model.
to axial currents of this thermal. And if you couple it to the Chern-Simons current of the SU3 group, then you can solve strong U1 problem. So this is the general picture that we're going to use. And in the next lecture, we probably go over the examples of how this works and what kind of the dark matter properties we can get and what kind of different classes of dark matter models we can get using this simple picture that's sometimes called the picture of portals to the stellar model. And these particles can exist at the weak scale or can exist even below the weak scale, which of course opens up enormously the possibilities for searching for them, because there is a lot more experiments that you can do at medium and low energies than at high energies where there is only one game. Okay, so we'll continue at 4:30.